starting this session now. This is, in case you're in the wrong place, Palances and the State and Revolutionary Strategy. The talk is going to be given by Jordan from the Wollongong branch of Socialist Alternative, and there'll be plenty of time for comments, questions, furious agreement, no doubt. We'll see. So take it away, Jordan.
Thanks, Louise. Well, the re-emergence of socialist politics in a number of countries, Corbynism in the United Kingdom, the Democratic Socialists of America, Podemos in Spain, the Left Bloc in Portugal, and so on, have led to a revival of debates about the capitalist state and socialist strategy. And a number of these organisations have developed to the point where the relationship between socialist politics and parliamentary democracy and the nature of the state under modern capitalism are immediate questions which they have to start to answer. They can't get away with, you know, total fudgy abstract ideas any longer. Palances has become a key reference point for a section of left-wing democratic socialists who, while being critical of traditional social democracy, are stridently opposed to the revolutionary Marxist position on these questions. They're attracted to Palances because he offers a relatively sophisticated defence of a left-wing but essentially reformist approach to the capitalist state. In particular, he outlines what he calls a democratic road to socialism. This strategy argues that socialism will not come about through a revolutionary mass uprising that smashes the capitalist state and replaces private ownership of the economy with democratic organs of workers' control. Instead, it puts forward a strategy that seeks to democratise the capitalist state while building extra-parliamentary institutions to act as a counterweight to the limitations of parliamentary democracy. The socialist left, then, in the strategy, must work both inside and outside the state, and over time, it is believed, through a series of breaks or ruptures, some people like one word or the other, to a classless society. And often this approach is backed up by a critique of the Russian Revolution of 1917, which argues that replacing parliamentary democracy with workers' councils leads to Stalinist dictatorship. So Ben Tarnoff, writing for Jackman magazine, argues, if sole reliance on representative democracy leads, on the one hand, to the dead end of social democracy, then sole reliance on direct democracy leads to another dead end in the form of bureaucratic dictatorship. These are very different outcomes, but they share a common theme. Both are marked by statism and a profound distrust of mass initiatives, wrote Palances. Both end up elevating an elite that claims to speak for the masses, whether social democratic politicians or Soviet bureaucrats, while actually depriving the masses of any meaningful opportunity for self-rule. Thus, the importance of developing state power and popular power at the same time. In combination, Palances believe the two can inhibit one another's worst tendencies and bring out their shared democratic potential. In the more immediate sense, this strategy is used to downplay the Marxist critique of parliamentary democracy and to lower the horizons of the socialist left in a reformist direction. And Vivek Shiba is very clear on this. So I'm going to read a quote which was partly read out in Jerome's talk, but not everyone was there, so it's fine. While we can allow for and perhaps hope for the emergence of revolutionary conditions where state breakdown is really on the cards, we can't build a political strategy around it as an expectation. We can't take it as the left's fundamental strategic perspective. Today, the political stability of the state is a reality that the left has to acknowledge. Our strategic perspective has to downplay the centrality of a revolutionary rupture and navigate a more gradualist approach. Now, in this talk, I'm not going to go through the whole development of Palances' thought, as interesting as that is, from his earliest writings to his final years, or discuss in tons of detail, you know, Eurocommunism and the kind of context in which he was writing in. What I want more to do is focus on three key arguments he makes in his final work, State Power and Socialism, which are taken up today by various sections of the kind of democratic socialist world. So I want to look at Palances' argument about the capitalist state, his strategy that socialists should work both within and outside the state and what he means by that, and take up some of the issues around dual power and revolution that have been the source of much discussion recently. So to start with the state, Palances' writings on the state are taken by many socialists today as offering a major advance on the revolutionary writings of Marx, Engels, Luxembourg, Lenin, and Trotsky. In particular, has argued that the classical Marxist tradition, in Palances' words, totally neglected the essential role of the state's political space. And leave aside whether they did do that, I don't think that's true at all, but what he means by this is that they neglected the relative autonomy of the state from capitalism and the importance of parliamentary democracy. And this is reinforced by socialists today, who argue that the transformation of the state under liberal democratic capitalism in the 20th and 21st centuries has rendered early writings obsolete. Now, Plants' writings on the state do offer some interesting insights in particular aspects of the modern state. And a series of his criticisms of social democratic and Stalinist theorists, a lot of what he says is kind of fair enough about why they're wrong about all sorts of things. He spends most of his time doing that, really. However, he does not offer a serious advance on the writings of revolutionary Marxists. Quite on the opposite, he retreats on a number of their key insights. More to the point, though, he doesn't offer a rigorous or compelling analysis of the contemporary capitalist state. Plancius repeatedly comes back to what he calls the institutional materiality of the state. That is, the deep penetration between the workings of the state and the exploitative class relations of capitalism. Unlike more right-wing social democratic theorists, he wants to root the capitalist state firmly in its relationship to the ruling class and oppressed classes. However, Plancius constantly equivocates between this conception of the state on the one hand and the other, seeing the state as a pretty open battlefield between different class forces, or as he famously puts it, the material condensation of the balance among class forces. And this leads him to repeatedly exaggerate the importance of parliamentary democracy and to link it in a very liberal way to the protection of individual liberty and freedom. So to unpack all this a bit. Like many reformist writers, Plancius counterposes the idea that the capitalist state is a violent apparatus to defend class rule with the complex reality of a state that seeks to mediate class conflict and administer society. So Plancius sees the fundamental contradiction between, you know, like the analysis that Marx makes in the 18th Brumaire and his declarations in the Communist Manifesto and elsewhere that the state is an instrument of class rule. This is particularly the case with modern liberal democratic capitalism. Plancius points to the development of the welfare state, the massive expansion of the public service and education, and the way in which parliamentary democracy is used, not just to manage divisions in the ruling class, but also the demands of the rest of the population. And in his mind, all of this makes the idea that the state is an instrument of class rule obsolete, even if all of these functions are rooted in various ways in the needs of capitalism. Now, it's undoubtedly the case that the capitalist state has changed since 1917, let alone since the days of Marx and Engels. It was like 150, 70 years ago or something. There have been important developments. However, I don't think any of these invalidate the central thesis about the state being an instrument of class rule to defend capitalism. So, again, to break down this a bit more, on the question of parliamentary democracy, Plancius' kind of argument is that universal suffrage was a conquest of the masses, as he writes, that has to be defended even into a socialist society. Now, there's some truth to what he's saying. Parliamentary democracy was not a spontaneous development of the rise of capitalism. It took serious struggle for the working class and its allies to force the ruling class to either create a democratic structure or to expand suffrage to the mass of the population. And we just have to think of the Chartist movement in industrial England or the civil rights movement in the United States, as well as many other examples. However, it's not the case that our parliamentary system is simply a conquest begrudgingly conceded to us by the ruling classes. The parliamentary system was created, in fact, as an alternative to the more radical proposals being pushed by the working class democratic movements of early capitalism. And Terry Irvine wrote a very interesting article a few issues ago in the Marxist Left Review, where he talks about how this played out in Australia. And he argues that the more radical proposals for yearly parliaments, recallable representatives, and so forth were sidelined by the capitalists when they adopted the modern parliamentary structure. And as we know, the bourgeoisie has developed, you know, quite sophisticated ways to undermine the democratic representation of workers and oppressed groups in all sorts of ways. Just look at the voter exclusion rate in the United States. And it's not just the formal proposals that moderated, the spirit of those struggles was crushed. When the early democratic movements wanted political democracy, they clearly believed that this could be used either to take the wealth away from the ruling classes or at least to give considerable political power to the working class. And neither of this turned out to be the case. Instead, we have a state which is elected through a thoroughly isolated and individualised system of secret ballots, which elects representatives over whom we have very little control, and that leaves the rest of the state machinery in the hands of unelected bureaucrats deeply tied to the ruling class. And on top of all of this, this whole apparatus is subordinated to the power the capitalists have over the economy. So when we see parliamentary democracy as an outcome of struggle from below, it needs to be qualified that this is an extremely distorted and alienated response to those struggles, embodied in institutions that are hostile to the spirit which motivated those initial demands. On the question of the violence of the state, Now, it's true that as capitalism has developed in complexity, the state has had to expand and develop a whole series of institutions that go well beyond just the police and the military. This has produced a modern state apparatus which has a significant degree of flexibility compared to the early European states of the 20th century. Undoubtedly, this is one of the reasons why the advanced capitalist states have been, you know, relatively more stable than the rest of the world, although there's a whole series of other factors as well, in particular, I think, the enormous wealth and power which the modern, which the kind of Western capitalist classes have at their disposal, as well as the role of the reformist parties and the trade unions. The liberal democratic state allows the ruling class greater room to manoeuvre in response to crises and discontent from below. If the ruling party is, for instance, discredited, a new government can be formed, and considering the nature of the state outlined before, you know, a party by a party that's most likely to be equally as dedicated to capitalism. Maybe the ruling class will have to grant some reforms in return, but that can help to stabilise things. And not having a single dictator or a tiny clique running the show can help in navigating debates within the ruling class or society at large. However, none of this means that the democratic state form has escaped the need for a violent apparatus to ensure capitalism's rule. And on one level, Polanski and those influenced by him are forced to acknowledge this. So Shibo, quoted earlier, also writes, "Today the state has infinitely greater legitimacy with the population than European states did a century ago. Further, its violent power, its power of surveillance, and the ruling class's internal cohesiveness give the social order a stability that has orders of magnitude greater than it had in 1917. And again, this points to an important half-truth, but has the same equivocation as Polanski's. On the one hand, the state is seen as an open battlefield for socialist forces who can exploit its contradictions to push a radical agenda, and as I'll talk about later, take control of sections of the state to push a socialist agenda. On the other hand, the state apparently is so powerful and violent that any attempt to forcibly replace it is doomed to defeat. And these left reformist theorists are unable to reconcile these two aspects of the state because they keep trying to insert their desire for a democratic road to socialism onto a structure utterly hostile to any such strategy. And this stops them from being able to create any coherent theory of the state as a whole. For while modern states might be more adaptable and stronger than previous states, they cannot escape the contradictions of capitalism. It's true that they may not face the exact problems of some of the early European states. For instance, there's not a struggle today, thankfully, between a feudal political class connected to a dying mode of production and the bourgeoisie struggling for some form of modernisation. They don't have to face, you know, exact problems of the peasantry and the crisis of agriculture, etc. And they manage to construct a new state which has a greater sense of legitimacy than those before. However, they have replaced all those contradictions with new ones, which, whatever their differences, have explosive consequences. The modern democratic state can't escape the contradictions of capitalism. It can't resolve the fact that it exists in an international system that is anarchic, competitive, divided, and violent. Nation states, whatever their form, can't eliminate the drive towards economic, social, and political crisis, imperial wars, or mass discontent. They can manage such tendencies, they can delay them, but they can't ultimately stop them. Just look at some of the crises which are wrecking democratic states all around the world today, whether it's Brexit in the United Kingdom, the election of Donald Trump in the United States, the economic stagnation of many advanced economies, the rise of China, its competition with the United States, etc. And at the end of the day, the violent apparatus of the state was built to ensure that when such crises emerge, they do not endanger the accumulation of capital. And this is precisely why, alongside the development of the democratic state, you also have a massive expansion of the police, the military, the justice system, etc. And you don't have to look at, you know, revolutions from 100 years ago to see that this is the case. Just look at France today. The strikes and our Yellow Vest rebellion against Macron has revealed very clearly that a deep crisis of legitimacy exists for the French liberal democratic state. In response, the ruling class in the state has used all its ideological abilities. Macron has given people addresses to the nation, which haven't been particularly successful, but he's given his go. The press has all united together, including the liberal press, to denounce the protests. Some mild reforms have been offered to try and, you know, slow down the kind of discontent. And, you know, there's been a whole role played by social liberal and democratic parties to try and undermine the momentum. However, when all this failed and tens of thousands of protesters blocked highways and descended on Paris, they wheeled out what was the ultimate guarantee of capitalist stability, violent force. They unleashed rubber bullets, tear gas, water cannons and batons. They amassed the police and put the military on standby. While the Yellow Vests have continued to heroically struggle, this violence has played an important role in limiting the movement and persuading the majority of the population who are broadly supportive of the Yellow Vests to avoid violence by staying at home or work. And this is only the most recent example of a worldwide delegitimization of neoliberal capitalism and its democratic structures that is going on at different paces all across the advanced capitalist world. I think what it reveals is the deep paradox of contemporary liberal capitalism. On the one hand, its greatest stability due to its particular state form, which encourages illusions about the democratic nature of society, how the state can't eliminate inequality, obviously, but in periods of crisis can't stop inequality from dramatically increasing. And it leads to all sorts of problems. Like at the moment, all the kind of organs of the bourgeoisie are saying, the IMF, the World Bank, etc., are saying to the advanced capitalist world that they need to do something about inequality. The inequality is getting too much, is leading to too much discontent, and yet they're not doing anything about inequality. No proposal that seriously addresses that. Even in Australia, where we're not facing this huge crisis, the Business Council of Australia can't get Labor and Liberal to agree to raise Newstart. It's a basic thing in the entire world, which they say is good for capitalism anyway. And when this discontent with the situation spills onto the streets or into the workplaces, the ruling class and the state have to crack down in order to remain in control. The social contract under democratic liberalism between the rulers and ruled is strained and under exceptional circumstances is broken. In fact, the ideological nature of liberal democracy cuts both ways. It encourages liberalism and reformism on the one hand, but on the other, when this crashes against the need of the state to use violence, it produces a serious political crisis that shakes people's faith in democratic institutions. All of this starts to bring us away, really, from Plantz's analysis of the state to his argument about socialist strategy, and here his softness on liberal democracy, which is often obscured by the very abstract level of his writings and the very imprecision of his writings, I think, comes out much more clearly. So Plantz puts forward three key points in his arguments for socialist strategy. He argues that the socialist movement should exploit the contradictions of the state to, in his words, carry out a deep-seated transformation of the state. Secondly, he argues that the left should also develop institutions outside of it based on direct democracy, but finally argues that these two struggles should complement each other rather than leading to the creation of a new workers' state. And so he's against those forms of direct democracy being coordinated and centralised in a way which challenges the bourgeois parliament. So to start with the struggle inside the state. Now, revolutionaries obviously are for exploiting the contradictions of bourgeois democracy whenever they're able. We are not ambivalent about elections or parliamentary democracy. Revolutionaries have run in elections to get socialists into parliament in order to relate to mass sentiment and to express the class struggle in the halls of power. However, this is not premised on the idea that we can carry out any significant transformation of the capitalist state. And here, the contradictions to Plantz's argument intensify. So in his book, The State Power and Socialism, he spends a lot of time arguing about why the state is anti-democratic, how it's connected to the ruling class, but then all of this flies out the window when he starts to talk about what the actual strategy is for the socialist left. So Plantz argues that socialists should intervene into the state to radicalise parliamentary democracy, not to fight to replace it with direct democracy from below. And he defends this by claiming that parliamentary representation is the only way to preserve political freedom. So in an interview with the then-Trotskyist Henry Weber, he quotes a social democratic defender of parliamentary democracy and kind of comments on it. So this is a social democrat who says, "If we want to maintain liberties, the plurality of expression, etc., then all I know is that throughout history, these liberties have always been coupled with a form of parliament." And then Plantz says, "Certainly expresses this in a social democratic form, but yet I wonder if there isn't a core of truth in that, if the maintenance of formal political liberties doesn't require the maintenance of the institutional forms of representative democracy. Obviously, they have to be transformed. It's not a matter of just keeping the bourgeois parliament exactly as it is." Now, this is a very different matter. Representative democracy does not maintain political liberty in any serious sense of the word. The vast majority of people are excluded from any real liberty under capitalism. Oppressed minorities are treated even worse. And political parties are not in this, world of freedom and political liberty under the bourgeois parliament, quite the opposite. Any party which is outside of the mainstream neoliberal consensus is hounded and confined and excluded as much as is possible. However, the real point of Plantz's praise of parliamentary representation is to undermine the benefits of popular workers' power. While Plantz argues that extra parliamentary movements and organisations are important in helping radicalise representative democracy, he is profoundly pessimistic about the democratic potential of workers' self-organisation. So he argues in the same interview, "Historically, every experience of direct democracy at the base
which is not being tied to representative democracy, has failed. To do away completely with the institutions of representative democracy, and to think that you will have direct democracy in the absence of institutions of representative democracy, it's never worked. Direct democracy, by which I mean direct democracy in the Soviet sense, has always and everywhere been accompanied by the suppression of political parties and the suppression of political and individual liberties. And he backs this up by an account of the Russian Revolution, which attempts to show that the system of workers' councils led to a dictatorship of experts and finally to Stalinist dictatorship itself. Now, Polanski doesn't offer any historical evidence, really, to back up this claim. He doesn't really need to, because this is what everyone else who's not revolutionary argues, basically. So it goes with the stream of mainstream, social democratic, liberal, and most anarchist criticisms of the Soviet regime. In reality, Stalinist dictatorship was built on the destruction of the workers' councils, not as an expression of them, following years of civil war and economic isolation, and then a counter-revolution. And Polanski doesn't just think that the workers' councils developed into a dictatorship because of objective circumstances. He blames it on the revolutionary politics of the Bolsheviks. So he also writes, "The seeds of Stalinism were well and truly present in Lenin, and not only because of the particularities of Russia and the Tsarist state with which he had to grapple." And he argues that that existed in the early Third International as well. And he just starts repeating what is to be done and all the classic questions about, like, he was an elitist, substitutionist, etc. The other examples Polanski uses also reveals his total misunderstanding of the nature of workers' power. So in the same interview, he raises examples of going to mass trade union meetings and, like, student occupations and stuff during May 68, and about how, you know, they were bureaucratically controlled by various left groups at certain periods. And modern examples of Polanski also raise Occupy Wall Street as the other example. But none of these are workers' power in any serious sense, and it's a silly comparison, really. They're not about democratic organs of the working class controlling production and then society. So organs like the workers' councils in Russia and Germany during and after World War I can only exist in a revolutionary situation in which the possibility of overthrowing the capitalist state is placed on the agenda by their very, very existence. And they involve the mass participation of millions in order to function. And at the heart, you know, the working class obviously is the leading element, but inevitably drawing in whole other sections of society involved in the revolutionary process. Contrary to Polanski's claims, the emergence of workers' powers led to the flourishing of individual rights and political freedoms and political parties as well. The Paris Commune had a plurality of parties, as did the Spanish Workers' Councils of 1936 to 37. And a key demand of the workers' councils in Hungary in 56 was the right to form political parties, which had been suppressed for quite a long period. In the more immediate sense, Polanski's arguments are used to subordinate popular power to bourgeois parliament. So in the same interview, he argues that the socialist left need a parallel struggle, outside of parliamentary struggle, he says, we also need a parallel struggle, a struggle against the institutions and apparatuses, giving rise to a whole series of instruments, means of coordination, organs of popular power, etc. However, this form of struggle should not aim to centralise a dual power type of counter-state, which would have been linked to the first struggle. And this is the classic left reformist strategy. The masses are needed in order to pressure the state and to give it, you know, to push it in order to give more radical demands some possibility. They need to be wheeled out to defend a socialist government when it comes under attack from the capitalist class. And they need to have enough, you know, level of coordination, initiative and popular support in order to do so, but not so much that they strike an independent course counterposed to that of the socialist government. And here, the elitist understanding of working class activity is clear. Socialism is not the self-emancipation of the working class. They are not the motor of history. Instead, they are to play the role of the servants, or at best, loyal critics, of the socialists in the bourgeois parliament. And when Polanski actually discusses a concrete situation, which is not very often, but when he does, it becomes even more clear how right-wing and reformist he is. So in his interview, he discusses the possibility of the Union of the Left, which is a coalition between the Socialist Party and the Communist Party in France, of getting elected. And he argues that unless there's mass protests and strikes as well, that probably just become a social democratic government that won't be very good. However, he starts to discuss what would happen if the working class did rally to support the government. And he argues about, like, what should they do? Polanski doesn't really say what they should do, to be honest. He just says what they shouldn't do. So he writes, "The real problem is to know how can we intervene in this process in order to deepen it. In this context, what does seem clearly impossible is any perspective of workers' counterpower, of organising factory council by factory council, soldier committee by soldier committee. Furthermore, I'd say that this would seem to me an extremely dangerous way to proceed. Such a course is the surest road to the total recapture of power by the bourgeoisie. Now, not only does he reject the idea that the socialist left should try and transform mass mobilizations into a counterpower to the capitalist state, he has no strategy to deal with the power of the capitalists. So when he discusses what a socialist government should do with the economic structures of society, even in a very radical situation, he argues, at no point should changes lead to the actual dismantling of the economic apparatus. Such a development would paralyze it and accordingly increase the chances of a boycott on the part of the bourgeoisie. So we're going to elect a left-wing government, which is going to have some protests supporting it, which is then not going to try and disarm the bourgeoisie, and is just going to try and pass some reforms against the bourgeoisie. We've seen this many times before, and it's been a failure every single time that has been attempted. So Poulantzis opposes the idea that the working class should try and create organs of power that overthrow capitalism and create a socialist state. He believes this will lead to a disastrous defeat for the working class. Today, though, a lot of his followers make a slightly different argument, which is also based on some things Poulantzis says, which is that the questions of kind of dual power and uprisings against the state simply will not arise in the advanced capitalist world. So Eric Blunk argues in an article recently that not only has there never been a victorious insurrectionary socialist movement under a capitalist democracy, but only a tiny number of workers have ever nominally supported the idea of an insurrection. Now, the current state of the socialist left and the class struggle seem to back up such an idea. Nowhere in the world is the working class in a position to seriously challenge the capitalist state. The left and the workers' movement have gone through several decades of defeats in most of the world. The imposition of neoliberalism in the 1980s accelerated the downturn and struggle, and we know, you know, the situation we're in. And now a kind of new socialist left is beginning to re-emerge, and in some countries some workers' struggle is happening, but it's only just beginning to work out what it should do. So in such a backward situation, it's easy to read off what is possible now and project that far into the future. However, I want to challenge this argument on several points. The first is to go back to what I said about the inability of capitalist democracies to contain the contradictions of capitalism. And this is true, not just in the sense they can't avoid crisis, etc. It's also the case that the liberal democratic state is just as much, in fact, in some ways even more, deeply rooted in capitalist social relations than other state forms. Yes, there's greater flexibility, but in other ways, as we're saying, more, you know, it's more attuned to the modern capitalist class and its interests. The violent core of the state, the unelected state machinery, and even the parliamentary sphere are all subordinated to the interests of capital and the power which they have. And every crisis in capitalist democracies over the last 100 years has revealed this to be the case. To take up more particularly the argument about dual power situations, whatever you want to call them, we can look at this from two angles, I think. First of all, it's true they are less examples of workers' power in the advanced capitalist world than in others. You know, since 1945, there's been multiple examples of dual power situations. Hungary in 56, Chile in 73, Poland in 81, Iran in 79, and so forth. And most of them have not been in the advanced capitalist world. However, a lack of recent examples in the capitalist world here, I can't be separated out from the general greater level of stability in those countries. From 1945 into the 1970s, the Western world was in the midst of one of the largest booms in capitalism's history. And when this stability started to break up and there was a revival of radical struggle, that ended with a defeat for the left and the imposition of neoliberalism and several decades of defeat for the left and the workers' movement. So it's not surprising, you know, in most countries even trade unions weren't going forward, let alone popular organs of workers' democracy challenging capitalist states. This, however, has to be qualified. First of all, there's a constant ambiguity of what we're actually talking about. So some people talk about the advanced capitalist world. Other people talk about capitalist democracies, which is what Eric Blank uses, which is a much broader term. It covers a lot of countries which are not a part of the Western world. Shiba argues that it's not relevant for the global south and most of the global... the global north and most of the global south. However, this is definitely not the case. Chile in 1973, for example, had been a relatively stable capitalist democracy since 1925, and then that kind of coup then, and then they had 20 years of democracy before that as well. Very similar to most of the Western world, to be honest. And a more recent example of a kind of workers' power situation arising is in Bolivia in 2003, when a combined indigenous peasantry insurgency and a proletarian radical trade union movement overthrew the democratically elected government and set up popular institutions of power, which from September to October in the city of El Alto controlled the city and drove out the democratically elected government and did start to pose a bunch of questions around insurrection and the like. Similarly, if you look at the capitalist democracies before 1945, they're filled with examples of popular institutions of workers' power arising and clashing with the democratically elected governments. The workers' councils of Germany and Italy, the factory occupations in France during the 1936 Popular Front government, the strikes and committees and popular assemblies during the 1919 Seattle General Strike in the United States, and the varied expressions of popular power in Spain during the Civil War, and so on and so forth. And obviously, there are varied levels of development between these different examples. However, their existence is almost written out by left reformists today. More to the point, the argument for the within and without strategy that is put forward by Polanski has the same problems. There are very few examples of majority socialist governments being elected in the Western democratic world. There's zero examples of them creating socialism out of that situation. And, you know, partly, you know, for similar reasons, the defeat of the left and the working class movement means these questions have been raised to the same level. And when they have arisen, there's not been so harmonious relationship between elected left-wing governments and workers' movements on the ground. There's always been clashes and tensions between them because they're following different interests, different dynamics to one another. So just to sum up, because I've spoken for a bit too long probably, I think obviously there's been this revival of a socialist movement, which has led to a revival of these very important debates about socialist strategy, about the nature of the capitalist state, about a whole series of questions I didn't get to talk about the Revolutionary Party, class alliances, etc. And I think that is really important. We want to relate to that, but we really want to make a hard argument for revolutionary politics within that, because we face a world of extraordinary crisis, of economic, political, social upheavals which are going on all around the world at the moment. And we know that the politics of left reformism cannot resolve those crises. So we need to fight for a revolutionary perspective within that broader milieu. I'll leave it there.